Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. Today I have a very special guest named Brian Hyman. And Brian has recently published the book called Recovery with Yoga, Supportive Practices for Transcending Addiction. It's got an orange and red cover. And I just finished talking with Brian. I always come back and do the intro after I speak with each person, and I'm just feeling a little bit vulnerable, a little bit, I don't know, sad, maybe touched, because number one, Brian is humble. He is humble. He has basically decided that he can't live on this earth alone without support and love of a community. And he doesn't want to have to be strong enough to handle the world all on his own. He doesn't want to be a lone wolf because he's seen what happens to lone wolves. And he saw it in his own life through his experience before he got sober. And I think it's just such a hard thing for us to accept that we are human. We are neurobiologically not meant to be alone, that it is through the support and love of our communities, our families, that we can heal together and be held together. And yet it's so hard because I would guess most of the people who are lone wolves got hurt by people. And that's why they've decided, hey, I'm on my own here. I don't have anything. I don't have anyone. I don't have a community. And frankly, I don't want them because they've hurt me. And it's a very difficult place to be, to decide you want to live, decide that life is short, decide that you're willing to take the risk of trusting again with discernment, but trusting again and becoming part of a community and becoming part of humanity again. And that's hard for a lot of us, especially if you have a lot of trauma, complex trauma, maybe disabilities, maybe neurodiversity, maybe introversion. It's very challenging. And yet that's how we're wired. We're wired for social connection. So I introduce you to Brian now. He's a lovely, lovely human being, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. We're so happy that you're on this journey with us, and we'd like to invite you to a few other activities. Number one, we have a Monday night yoga therapy clinic, and each month we choose a different topic. It's a deep time together, both professionally and personally, and we do offer CE units. So come join us on Monday nights if you will. We'll see you there, and until then, let's get into our podcast. Welcome, Brian, author of Recovery with Yoga, Supportive Practices for Transcending Addiction. We're so happy to have you here.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Amy.
So let's just start from the top, Brian. Where are you talking to us from?
Physically, I'm in California. I'm sober, 14 years. That's another physical aspect of where I am coming from. And this book that I wrote was based on my experience through my personal recovery and also being a yoga teacher for 13 years, working in a treatment center, working with people who are in the early stages of trying to combat and overcome addictive behaviors and things like alcoholism, drug addiction, and many things that are related to mental health issues, depression, anxiety, stress. So this has been the work that I've been doing for many years now, and that's where I am in my life these days, is taking the teachings of yoga that I've learned both personally and professionally and trying to bring them to people that could use them, who either don't know about them or aren't aware of them, and trying to make these ancient teachings compatible and contemporary for our modern culture. So that's pretty much what the idea of the book is and what I've been doing these days.
That's so great. You know, I was reading the book this week, and I thought exactly that. I know many people that are struggling with all types of addiction. And I just kept thinking, this is like a really great introduction to yoga philosophy, to some different chants, to, you know, the teachings of yoga. And so number one, I just want to thank you for that, because it's a book I can give to people who are struggling with addiction and want maybe another way to look at the struggle and the suffering of life and how they might be able to manage that. It's very practical.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. That was one of the ideas behind the book was they can be esoteric. They can be for yogis only. And there are a lot of people I've noticed over the years that feel like they're not a yogi, or they're not sure what the Sanskrit is, or the chanting, or the mantras, or they're not sure how to do a pose. And so hopefully this book is relatable and accessible to people who are non-yogis or don't know Sanskrit or aren't familiar with spirituality. The book's been out for a few months now, so some of the reviews that have come back from readers is that they don't have experience with yoga, and some say they don't have experience with addiction, but the book was very helpful because it dealt with universal principles, fundamental ideas, and that was a main point of writing the book as well, is to just focus on principles so we can all relate there.
Honestly, that's another thing I loved about the book. The principles, I just want to read some of them. And I already told you in an email my favorite principles of what you've written. Honesty, and each of these has a chapter. Honesty, acceptance, surrender, courage, vulnerability, willingness, humility, contentment, and authenticity. I just felt like what you wrote in those chapters, especially, I loved all of it. But for me, like all of us need to read about those things, whether you're an addict or not, it's super applicable to just being human.
Exactly. This is all part of the human condition. So whether you're an addict or not, whether you're religious or not, spiritual or not, wealthy or not, educated or not, these are what Dalai Lama calls part of our global ethic. We can all agree on and meet here at these levels of universal or fundamental principle. These are moral ethical codes, but they're also touching upon our shared set of emotions and feelings. We can all meet there as well. So inherent to all these principles are emotions and feelings, where again we can relate to love, for example. We can all relate to love. We can all relate to sadness. We can all relate to anger. We're going to find these things in the book as well. So I wanted to make sure this book wasn't just for people who can do Warrior Two or handstand.
And also, I think, having had some family members and friends with severe addictions, it's a beautiful book of concepts to share together. I mean, because it's specific to addiction, but it's also specific to the human condition of suffering. I think any auntie or any sister or brother could get together and say, hey, let's read this chapter about being honest and why that's so important. And then let's talk about it.
Yeah, that's a beautiful idea. Part of recovery is sharing it with others. So let's say a father and a family get sober, the whole family benefits, the wife, the kids, the aunts, the uncles, the nephews, the nieces. Recovery is meant to be shared. So if there are things in here that can be shared at a general universal level, like honesty, it's beautiful. And especially if it's coming from a place where it's really hard earned. When someone gets sober, for them to get honest and to really practice honesty, not just in the beginning stages, but as a practice, just like yoga or anything else that's a spiritual discipline or practice, it's continued. There's no finish line or a certificate at the end. Oh, you're honest? Congratulations, you never have to practice that again. No, it's something we do as long as we can. And so it's neat if we can continue to practice these things with the people we love. Like you mentioned, it's a beautiful idea is to share it. So it becomes embodied as a family principle. If dad, for example, gets sober and practices honesty, and the children and everyone else in the home sees this and they see the benefit and they realize, wow, I love dad's honesty. He's really honest. He doesn't lie. I want to be like that. It's a very attractive quality.
So, can we go to your story? Can you just give us a brief overview? Maybe what was happening before you decided to get sober? Because I think a lot of people think about getting sober for years. They just go through the loop of, oh my gosh, this is not sustainable. My life isn't what I want. I'll try to do better, but then we fall back down. So, could you tell us a little bit about your story?
Sure. I realized I had a problem with drinking. I thought it was what everyone did. At least that's what I was seeing and what I had rationalized to myself as somewhat normal. I was a teenager and I would see it in movies and TV shows and my peer group, my friends. It was just a thing that we did, went out, had some drinks, and would go to parties and have fun. But I started to notice that I liked to drink a little bit more than everyone else. And I didn't really think too much about the repercussions, if it was drinking and then having to drive home, or drinking too much and then having to get up the next morning for school or work, and I didn't really care too much about that type of stuff. And it progresses. Addiction is a progressive type of thing where as the years go on and one drink becomes two, two drinks becomes five, five drinks becomes a drink plus some drugs now and some other behaviors, it really starts to diminish our ability to perceive things correctly, to see things clearly, to feel things in a right way, meaning being able to label our feelings and emotions correctly. So I was in a place where I got to 34 years old. So somehow I did things that were somewhat normal. You know, I went to college, I got a degree, I had a job after school, I moved to New York City, and I started to pursue some of my creative endeavors and dreams. But all the while I was drinking underneath this. And at some point, there's this gray area, this subtle kind of place where I'm not sure how or when it happened, but drinking becomes, for me, it was alcohol. That was my thing mostly. It just becomes something that's an everyday thing. And it starts as something to take the edge off at the end of the day, to relax. I deserve this. I had a long day. I'm stressed. It helps me calm down. And again, these are the, after years of being sober, I realized these are the ways I coddled myself. I rationalized it. I justified it. I deserve this drink. I had a long day, that type of behavior or thinking. I realized I was sick. I was hypnotized by the lure or the enticements of addiction. Addiction is like this heavy, dark energy. It just kind of sucks you in. It pulls you in, and you don't know what happened until you're dancing with it. You can't get out of this situation, and you're going down, and there's no happy ending until the recovery piece comes in. And luckily, I got to a place where I was just drinking, and it was an everyday thing. And then I'm starting to lose the jobs, and I'm starting to lose the relationships and friends, and I'm losing my sanity, most importantly, at the end of my drinking career, where you don't care too much about family or friends or your own health or your own well-being, and you're doing things that are dangerous. And what happened for me was my mother got sick. She had a brain tumor. And it was brain cancer, and it was terminal. And this really woke me up. I was able to get sober for a little while until the end of that period. And I was able to be there when she passed away. And something really woke up within me that life is short. She was fairly young when she passed, and she didn't want to pass. She didn't want to die, but she didn't really have a choice. And that was the deciding point for me. It was a catalyst that her passing was my rebirth. Her death woke me up that I have the gift of life and I'm wasting it. And I have the miracle of life. I'm alive. And there's a lot of people that want to be alive, and for whatever reason, they can't be. But I am at that point. I'm alive, and I need to stop wasting my life. And it took a little while, but I finally got into a 12-step program. And the rest, as they say, is history. I did what was suggested. I worked the 12 steps. I went to meetings. I found fellowship. I found spiritual practices. I started reading a lot of the books that became source material for this book that I wrote. I didn't know at the time. I'm reading the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the Yoga Sutras, the Dhammapada. I don't know what I'm reading, but it sounds good. So I'm taking it all in. And I'm reading stuff from all the traditions, Christianity and Judaism and Hinduism and Sufi poets. And I'm just taking it all in. I was so hungry because for so many years, I was quenching that hunger that I had for spirituality with alcohol and substances. And it was the wrong type of nourishment or sustenance. So now I was actually feeding myself something healthy, which was spirituality and yoga and mindfulness. And so I got sober. And then it was within my first year of sobriety that I realized yoga was such a huge part of my recovery, because it gave me a chance to heal at all levels, mental, emotional, physical, spiritual. And the next thought that came to me, it wasn't my idea to become a yoga teacher or to write a book or do any of the work I've been doing, but I wasn't aware that yoga was this powerful. And I thought, if there's anything that I can do with what I've been given, is maybe I can let some other people know that there's something here in case you need it, and it's yoga. And it can be applied to recovery in some really powerful ways. And so all of a sudden, this hope to die drunk got a new lease on life. I got a new chance to live. And not only that, I got a purpose, and my purpose was to try to share my experience, strength, and hope with others using the teachings of yoga. And I'm one of the lucky ones. I'll just share this last piece. I just found out last night, a man I knew in my recovery passed away. He had relapsed and he died of alcoholism. I just found out last night. So I woke up with those thoughts and I remember him, and we got together, his daughter and I, and my daughter, we would do play dates. And alcoholism, drug addiction, it kills people. It's not a joke. And that's what I think what makes my work feel that much more important to me I'm not saying anyone else has to love this work or like this work or do anything with this work, but I know it means something to me because I work in a treatment center and I am sober. So whether it's my personal life or my professional life, I see it quite often. This is a fight. But if you have the right tools and you equip yourself with the right weapons, you can survive, not just survive, you can thrive in recovery. And I'm really one of the lucky ones. I'm so grateful. And I used to hear people who got sober say, "Oh, I'm a grateful alcoholic." And it almost sounded sort of cliche. And I'm sober 14 years. And from the bottom of my heart, I'm really grateful, especially when I heard last night that a friend of mine passed away. I'm really grateful. And thank you for asking because I didn't come to this, this was a lived experience. So thank you for allowing me to share that.
Thank you. And I think so many of our listeners can relate. So, do you feel you could have stayed sober if you had not found yoga? Do you feel like it was the combination of yoga and 12 steps and a lot of other things? But if we had taken the yoga out, do you think it would have been sustained?
Probably. The 12 steps are a really powerful cognitive behavioral type of therapy that will really help you figure out how you think, why you think a certain way, what those thoughts are attached to in relation to expectations and feelings and emotions and memories and the actions that are associated with those types of thoughts and memories and expectations. So the 12 steps are really powerful in my experience. I probably could have stayed sober and would still be sober, but the yoga piece supercharges, it's a supplement, it complements the 12 steps in a way where, for example, the 12 steps are therapeutic in that I can talk to a sponsor or someone who has been through the work who has more time sober than me, and I can share with him my thoughts and he can share his suggestions or ideas based on his experience, and we can have fellowship in a meeting. When I take my practice or my problems or my shortcomings or my defects or whatever's going on in my life to my yoga mat, that's where I do the experiential work. All the stuff that was talked about in the meeting, all the stuff that we read about in our literature and 12-step philosophy. And when I take it to the mat, that's when I get a chance to figure out where it lives in my body, where I'm storing that sadness or that resentment, where I can connect the dots at a level that's holistic, meaning mind, body, spirit, and how it affects my thoughts and my speech and my actions. So when I'm done with my practice, I realize my yoga mat is like a magic carpet. It really takes my recovery to a whole different level. So literally, it elevates my recovery to a place where, without awareness of breath, for example, without mindfulness of movement, for example, I'm probably just going to huff and puff my way through life and just swing my arms around and slap my feet down on the ground. But my practice, my yoga practice, the physical practice, but also the philosophy, a lot of that's in the book, it really grounds me in a way where it does, for me personally, go above and beyond just sort of a regular 12-step program or a regular treatment center program. These things will work. They do work, but why not add something beneficial extra to it? If you have an ice cream sundae and you have the option, do you want whipped cream on top of that? Of course, I want whipped cream. You want a cherry on top? Yeah, of course. Why not add some more good things on top of the already good thing that you have?
Yeah, two things while I'm listening. Number one, I'm hearing that you are taking kind of the cognitive behavioral approach and embodying it. So that's really interesting. And then also, there are people who the suffering is actually in their body that I think, even if they weren't quite as, I don't want to say intellectual as you, because I know I hear you saying this is an experiential process, but you clearly can read these ancient texts and digest them. And some people, that's not their thing, but they can come in through the body. And that's another way I think yoga or yoga therapy can kind of supercharge, as you say, because maybe they're kinesthetic people more than academic type philosophy people.
Absolutely. I've seen it as a teacher. I've been teaching about 13 years now, and I've taught in different gyms and studios. And then primarily, I've been teaching in treatment centers and specifically the population of people that are in recovery. So I've noticed there are people where you'll say, let's say namaste, or we'll use a yoga term or karma or dharma or something that we think is every day or it's sort of transcended the ancient scripts and it's made it into our everyday vernacular. And we think that everyone knows what karma is, but at some point it can stay at an intellectual level. And it's an amazing thing to witness as a teacher when you see what someone is doing with their body. For example, someone gets into a hip opener and all of a sudden they start to cry. Meanwhile, you haven't said anything as the teacher, and the music's instrumental, so there's no lyrics or words, but something within them, in that moment, in that space, that shared space, that collective safe space we've created for them to practice, they feel that there's something that needs to be released in that moment. And what I've done over the years is after teaching, we'll make a little circle and we'll share our experience with the practice. And you'll hear someone who was crying in a hip opener talk about how they felt like they were able to let go of an old abandonment issue or something that had to deal with rejection or betrayal or sexual trauma. I'm glad that these days, when I started teaching, and maybe you remember this as well, these ideas, somatics and the body storing trauma, and it was out there. And I love that today it's so much more at the forefront. It's so prevalent that there's almost no getting away from it. This trauma-informed yoga that we're doing today is, if you don't heal the body, if you don't figure out where you're storing these things, it's not going to get healed. You can't hold sadness and grief and depression in your heart that much longer. Your heart will start to have some effects. You can't keep all that stress in your shoulders. You can't keep those resentments in your lower back. Your body's going to start to break down. And it's interesting because it's now becoming more common. Back to your question, the people who aren't into the scriptures or the Sanskrit, they're coming at it from this whole different approach where they're physically finding their empowerment in a warrior pose. And that's fierce. That's amazing to see someone who's weak, someone who's gone through an issue where they've been abused or they've had a really hard time, and they're standing in warrior two and they're crying, but they're tears of triumph. They're finally lifting themselves up away from their past, away from their brokenness, and they're standing there and breathing and they're holding that warrior two. And as the teacher, you're trying to hold back your tears because it's so damn powerful. Powerful to look at, and you realize that person's body is now empowered. It's so much stronger than it was before this class. That person just found their strength. They're not a victim anymore.
I love that. Just taking that in for a moment. So important to feel embodied in our healing. There was another little point I wanted to make. Apparently, the Bills, who created the Big Book, were part of something called the Oxford Group, who studied with Vivekananda. So what I've heard is that the 12 steps are actually very much around yogic principles, but framed in a more secular way, if you will, to reach out to more people. Have you heard that? And what do you think of that?
Yeah, the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step groups, the Oxford group was part of the history. And there's literature, there's books about this. And it's neat because it was the same time. It was the early 1930s. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous was written and published 1939. So yoga was around. Vivekananda, he was making his way. And when you read that text, there's a reason it's held up for nearly 100 years now. I was at a 12-step meeting last night and we're reading from it. It's still very relevant. It is dealing with principles, and there are a lot of yogic concepts in there without using yogic terminology. It's very simple things. And since you mentioned the principles, I think it wasn't intentional, but the 12th step, for example, says having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. So we can stop right there. Having had a spiritual awakening
Right.
as the
Boom.
result of these steps. Wait a second. Spiritual awakening, 1939, you're just telling the general public. That's pretty edgy. That's out there to say, having had a spiritual awakening, you're not talking to a spiritual group. You're talking to a group of drunks. You're talking to the regular public. So they were already speaking in this language. They were already trying to normalize spirituality. And it was just interesting because it's not only held up for nearly 100 years, it's timeless. And so when they talk about the principles, again, it's a timelessness. The rest of that step is having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. So when we take a look at the 12 steps, each one is associated with a principle. There's honesty, hope, faith, courage, integrity, willingness, humility, open-mindedness. Most of these are in my book, and then I added some that I found over the years that are also beneficial. And so what they're really getting down to is we're talking about principles. For us specifically, we'll talk about resentments. We'll talk about taking an inventory. We'll talk about our character defects. We'll talk about making amends. But at the heart of all this work, 12-step work, you'll find principles. It's about the principles, always coming back to the principles. Because if we get stuck at the outer level, let's say someone does heroin, another person does meth, another person uses food, another person uses sex, this other person uses alcohol. If we stay at that outer level and try to figure out our common solution, we're going to be so stuck on these differences. Wait a minute, you do heroin, you do meth, you do crack, I just do this, and then you just do that. So we're not the same. But if we can get rid of all the outer stuff and get down to why do you use your substance? I'm lonely. Wait a second, I'm lonely too.
Right.
You use yours. I'm sad. Oh, that's why I do my thing. I'm sad. What do you do? I'm bored. Oh my gosh, me too. And that's the principle or the feeling at that subtle level where all the outer stuff disappears. So it's interesting because they wrote a book back to that history. I think it is based on a lot of those timeless qualities, whether it was Vivekananda, as you mentioned, or Christ or Buddha or Krishna. You're going to find all these teachers and teachings, they all sort of point back to things that the human condition can relate to. I think we can all agree on anger. Anyone ever been angry here? Me. Anyone ever felt sad? Me. Everyone ever felt lonely? Yeah, me. And if we can find that place where we can connect, that yoga, right? Yoga means union. If we can find the yoga of the emotion, time when you felt sad and I felt sad, we can also find the healing or solution together if we can stay at that level without getting into, but why are you lonely? Yeah, your reason's different than mine. We're not the same. And then we get into the separation. That's not yoga. And that's what leads a lot of people to drinking and using is that feeling of isolation or separation. So a lot of the 12-step program is coming back to our wholeness or completeness. That's why the big part of the program is fellowship, service, unity, and recovery. These are these three principles. Since we're talking about principles, we focus on service, helping others, unity, which is yoga, and recovery, like action, karma. It's do something. Get into action, work a program. That's a practice.
All right, well, let's get into the first principle that I really love that you started with. I tell my yoga therapy clients all the time that nothing is going to happen until we get honest about what is. It doesn't do any good to spend 2 or 3 years dancing around. I mean, we could do that if you want, but it would be better if we just, at least within yourself, get honest. So tell us how you think honesty, and you write about this in the book, connects to number one, helping people with addiction, but I think it really connects to all suffering.
Since we talked about the 12 steps, honesty is the principle associated with the first step, which is to admit powerlessness and unmanageability in one's life. Without honesty, I think we're going to waste a lot of time unless we can really get honest. We wouldn't go to a doctor. Well, some people might, but your doctor can't help you unless you're honest. If you go to the doctor and you say, I don't feel well, and the doctor says, what's wrong? And you have something that's wrong, but you're not really sure how to explain it because maybe it's a little bit embarrassing. So you don't explain what's really going on and you just sort of give out some general symptoms. Your doctor can't help you. You can't be helped in that situation unless you get honest. What's really going on? Well, I have some bleeding. Well, where's the bleeding? Somewhere inside. Be specific. Or the doctor can't help you. And we have to let go of, what keeps us from honesty. And I talk about this in the book is this false sense of pride and we're embarrassed or there's shame or I don't want to tell you where I'm bleeding because it's really embarrassing. But I can't help you. And it's like the alcoholic or the addict, like, how much do you drink? Well, I just have a few drinks every now and then. How many? When? Tell me. I can't help you unless you tell me. If you drink once a month, that's a lot different than every single day. You have to be honest. Unless we're honest with our innermost selves, being honest with others isn't going to happen either. So the first thing is we get really honest with ourselves. In the case of someone who needs to be in a program of recovery, we have to sometimes literally look into the mirror and say, I need help. I'm dying here. I can't do this on my own. That's usually how honesty begins for a lot of people is I am out of answers and I need some help. I'm dying here. It's very ironic with step one. A lot of people who see that step or think about the idea of admitting powerlessness, there's this ego thing, this prideful thing that I'm not powerless. I can handle this. I can do this. But there's something so empowering when someone says, I need help. That gut level honesty, it's the kind of thing you see and you go, wow, It brings tears to your eyes when you see someone who finally gets to the level within themselves where they say, at that level of honesty, can you help me? I can't do this anymore on my own. And the change happens.
You know, we think of strength as kind of bulking up and I got this. And actually, strength is humility. Humility to say, I don't have this. I don't know everything. I'm not capable of handling my life. Like, that's actually the strength.
Yeah, that's the paradox of getting into recovery, especially with step one, is a lot of people, myself included. So a lot of these things that I'll talk about, it is coming from my personal experience. I didn't want to admit powerlessness because that meant that I was weak, I was a loser, I failed at life, you're going to make fun of me, I don't want your judgment. And so I'm going to just keep hanging on, pretending like I got this. Like I can handle this on my own. No, thank you. I don't need your help. Meanwhile, I'm dying inside. And I'm physically falling apart, and I'm mentally falling apart, I'm emotionally falling apart. But I still am so full of some sort of weird sense of pride that I just can't tell anybody that. And a lot of that comes from culture, it comes from media, it comes from upbringing, it's generational, it comes from a lot of different places. And I think it's a really neat movement I've seen recently just to get to a place where we can be honest without the shame. And without the judgment, especially around mental health issues and addiction recovery issues, alcohol issues, substance abuse issues, it's a beautiful thing to see when we're able to just get honest and say, I've had problems with depression. I get stressed out. It's neat because a lot of us look at spiritual teachers or yoga teachers as almost they're not supposed to be stressed or angry. I had someone ask me about getting angry. I said, yeah, I still get angry all the time. And they said, I can't imagine you getting angry. You're always so calm. I said, I'm a human being. I get angry. I just don't handle it the same way I did 15 years ago. 15 years ago, I would have punched a wall or kicked something or screamed or held it inside until it finally imploded. Now I just talk to somebody or I go for a walk or I write in a journal or I go to my prayer or my meditation practice or I do yoga. So the anger is not going anywhere, but it no longer has the power to make me go take a drink or make me do something that I'm going to regret or have to make an amends for.
Are you looking for a community that you can be a part of? Well, I think I have just the thing for you. Between all of our listeners on the Yoga Therapy Hour and beyond, plus all of our mobile app users, Optimal State mobile app, between all of you and then the 5,000 people on our newsletter list, we are going to have community get-togethers every 2 weeks in the months of June, July, and August 2025. And we're going to get together on the new moon and the full moon and really set intentions together, both personally, professionally, but also as a community. We're going to meditate, we're going to reflect, we're going to journal, we're going to talk. And these are going to be completely free for the months of June, July, and August. So we're inviting all of you. We'll put the information in the show notes, and we would love to see you join us on the new moon and the full moon in June, July, and August. So the next principle is acceptance. How did you finally accept? Just use that example. The way that you were handling anger was not appropriate and not getting you where you wanted to go in life. What's the thing that can help people accept that I'm at rock bottom here? It's time for change. I mean, I know when you hit rock bottom, you don't have a choice, but do we have to wait until that point? That sounds horrible.
It would definitely be a lot more beneficial if people could get the help they need way before they hit rock bottom. But unfortunately, it does take what it takes. And a lot of people do need to hit their own personal bottom before they're finally ready to wave the white flag and say, help me, to really accept where they are. In the book, I sort of use a common sense example, which is, can you accept the sky is blue? Most of us can accept that the sky is blue, that the ocean is deep. Most of us can agree the ocean is deep, that trees are green, that flowers bloom. So these are all things that are common sense. If we can get into that way of thinking, can't we all also accept that sometimes human beings have issues with stress and sometimes they don't handle it in a healthy way? Can we also agree that when we need help, we can probably ask for it? So I don't think we need to wait till we get to the end of our rope to ask for help. But unfortunately, for whatever reason, a lot of us do. I think it is a lot of ego and a lot of pride, and it's a false bravado and it's a false sense of self that somehow I'm supposed to know what to do with this problem myself. And I've never seen someone get sober on their own. I've never seen someone learn yoga on their own. We always have a teacher, we have a mentor, we have a role model, we have a therapist, we have a sponsor. So we have helpers, we have community, we have sangha, kula, we have fellowship, we have people who have come before us. We can accept that we're human. That's one of the main themes of that chapter is if you have a lot of fear, guess what? So do most people in the room. If you just take a look around wherever you are, even if you're driving right now, listening to this podcast, the people in the cars around you are probably also harboring, holding fears about their day. They probably also have stress. We can all accept that we're human beings. We all have things to work on. If you were perfect, you probably wouldn't be here. You'd graduate this human level of existence, you'll go somewhere else. If you're here, it means you probably have some things to work on, which is good. I love it. There's no end to this. There's still things that I work on accepting now, even, nearly 15 years into my personal sobriety. These principles, they get, I wouldn't say easier with time, but our perception changes. Back to honesty, for example, there were certain things I can get honest about 15 years ago, but only sort of honest. I wouldn't tell you the full truth, the whole truth. I've gotten to a place where in my personal life, I don't really have much pride or ego the way I did all those years ago. So if I have something going on with me that may be considered faulty, I don't really have a problem these days telling you, like, maybe today I'm stressed, or maybe today I have some financial fear. I don't have a problem telling you because if I don't tell you, that secret's going to sicken me and I don't like to be sick. So I'd rather just tell someone. And that's what acceptance is just accept it, whatever's going on today. If the sun is shining, can you accept that? Yeah, okay. If it's raining, you're not going to get the rain to stop. So you might as well accept that it's raining. The same way you're not going to get to change that. If you have a fear, it's like rain. Just accept it. It's there. And just like the rain, it'll stop. That fear will go away. So we get a chance to just practice with these things.
I love all that you're saying. And going back to having the humility to ask for support and become part of a community and admit that we're human just like anyone else. There is this great book, it's probably 15 years old, called Tribe by Sebastian Younger with a J-U-N-G-E-R. And they did all this research on people coming home from the military assignments who had PTSD, CPTSD, complex trauma. And they followed them and looked at who ended up overcoming it and getting back to a more normal life, I put in air quotes, and who went into addiction and who didn't survive and who ended up leaving the planet. And the one thing that they could find was the people who had a community who healed with their community, meaning their family, their friends, their colleagues, back at home, the people who were able to make that adjustment and become part of a community were the ones who made it. So I don't know why that's so hard for us to admit that maybe we need other humans. I mean, it seems like such common sense, but I think you're right. It's that ego saying, no, I got this. I can do this on my own.
Yeah, and that statement, I heard someone share that when I first got sober. There was a man with a lot of time sober. We used to call him old timers, now we call him long timers. So this was a guy with 20 something years sober, and I had just a couple weeks sober. And he said, the worst thing you can say in your recovery, and he said, I know. As soon as you think you know, like someone says, you know what might be a good thing? Maybe try yoga. I know. I know what that's all about. This idea that we think we know. We think, I got this. I don't need your help. I don't need your suggestions. I know. I know. What he said was, that's one of the most ignorant things we could say. And that's where it comes from, is a place of, it's not an intention ignorance. We don't even know how ignorant it is to think that we know everything. We know we got this. Back to what you shared and what I shared as well, is this idea, I got this. There's a blindedness there. We have no idea how lost we are in that moment, thinking, I got this. One, no one ever put that on you. Why would you think you need to have that or hold that all by yourself? We're meant to do this stuff together. Every spiritual tradition I've studied that makes any sense to me, every religion I've read about and practiced that makes any sense to me, the community is the heart of it. This is even indigenous traditions, shamanistic traditions. It's community service, it's community gathering, it's their community, community, community. We either heal together or nothing. There is no alternative. If you leave the tribe, if you wander away from the pack, you'll get picked off. Our greatest survival rate is we stay as a herd, as a tribe. We stay together. We do this together. We ride the highs together. We ride the lows together. We go through our highs together. We call each other. Guess what? I just got a promotion at work. Yay, awesome. And then next year, guess what? I just got laid off from that job. Oh, man. But we do it together, both the stuff that brings joy and the stuff that brings the suffering. If we do everything together, we can make it through everything together. The lone wolf doesn't survive. And I see that. And that's what happened, I think, to my friend that I mentioned. You know, he went off on his own. He stopped going to meetings. He stopped engaging with the community. And it's a dangerous place to be, stuck in your own head with your own thoughts and your own solutions and your own ideas without some input from people who have been where you've been and may offer some light, some support.
I think it's so hard though, because a lot of the people with trauma, complex trauma, the lone wolves of the world, the reason they're in this situation in the first place is because people have hurt them. So to then come back and say, yeah, but you need to try again. These people are better. These people, they're not going to hurt you, which they are, by the way. That's part of being human too, is we hurt each other. I think that's, I don't know if that's where the surrender comes in. I'm not sure how to convince people, like, I know you've been hurt by people, and yet people are the solution for your hurt. How do you help people through that juxtaposition?
Yeah, there's absolutely a trust issue there when we're asked to go talk to those guys over there. When I have issues with men who have abused me or men who have beat me or men who have told me I'm a loser or a failure, how am I going to go trust that group of guys I don't even know? I already have my experience with men who have shown me that I'm worthless. I'm not going to take a chance again with this group of guys. And there's definitely a trust issue. So something that happens in 12-step programs is we learn to take contrary action, and we do it in a loving way in a community space where it's a sacred space. There's no way to explain it. And technically, it's an anonymous group. I'm not even supposed to talk about it. But I do want to let people know that I've been going to, I don't know how many thousands of 12-step meetings. It is a loving space. It's a safe space, a sacred space where no one's judging you. And if they are, it's their problem, not yours. And it's a free, open space to share whatever it is you need to share. So something that I learned was I isolated right before I got sober. I drank alone. I was that lone wolf. So I was the person who was lonely and desperate and depressed and sad. And I didn't even know how to have a conversation with anybody anymore because it had been so long before I talked to other people. I just really boarded myself up into my little apartment. And now I get to some meetings. And I'm being told I'm supposed to connect with other people in the meeting. How am I supposed to do that? And it starts in very, very subtle, very innocent, very small steps, very one thing at a time thing. So it's little things like just start to say hi to people, just start to be part of the group in any way you can. Maybe the next time they ask for a volunteer to read a part of the literature at the beginning of the meeting, maybe you can volunteer. Maybe you can turn around and help the person next to you. Is there one way? I don't think so. I think everyone has to find their own way. So for me, what I was given was an opportunity to take a commitment, to take action, basically. So I had such a hard time relating to people. Somebody suggested I become a greeter at a 12-step meeting. I said, "What is that?" They said, "You greet people." I said, "What does that mean?" When people come, you welcome them. You shake their hand, say hi, smile. I said, "Oh, geez, okay, I'll try it." I mean, I was 34 years old. You think I know how to say hi to somebody, but you get into this place where you're in this pattern for years. It gets really hard to get out of that pattern again. And so that's how I started to trust people was basically I just started to say hi to some people. Hi, I'm Brian. Welcome. What's your name? Part of me felt like I was 5 years old, 10 years old again, really putting myself out there. It was very vulnerable. But those little tiny baby steps, just try. I'd rather know I did that. Even if I'm risking getting hurt again, it was worth it because to stay in that place of brokenness and never try again, it becomes very sad to just give up on the world and give up on humanity. If we had a bad experience, you know, as kids or in our upbringing, that was then. I heard a teacher share this years ago. She said, if you had a bad childhood or a bad experience or there was abuse or you have PTSD, and that's not your fault. If that was in your past and you were a child and things happened to you, it's not your fault. But if you're an adult now, you can do something about it. What you do now, that is on you. So whether it's going to therapy, going to a meeting, Zoom or online groups these days, that's a great way for people. I had to do it in person. There was no Zoom when I got sober. So I literally had to go and put my hand out and shake someone's hand before COVID, before all the sanitizer. It was embarrassing. Now you can actually just do it at home, which is, I would imagine, is really a great introduction to starting to get back into the world, to start to trust people again, to just start to put little comments into the chat in the Zoom group, and to start to get to a place where you can connect again, but most importantly, start to trust other people again.
You know, all that you're talking about is really touching me deeply. I think that healing together and learning to trust each other again, even in our imperfections, because I've had a lot of friends and family in 12 steps and they've had mentors that have hurt them again. It happens, but that doesn't mean you can't trust all people. It doesn't mean that you just should shut down and not have any relationships. That's irrational.
Yeah, and it usually is an old pattern. It's a defect behavior or default setting for a lot of us is, and it reaffirms that old wound like, oh, yep, I knew it. I tried to give this guy a chance. He's just like my uncle. Screw it. All people suck. I'm done. And we have to try to figure out how to steer that Titanic away from that iceberg and to start to take those incremental little shifts toward, you know what? Maybe that wasn't the right guy. I'll just try again and try again and try again and try again. At some point, the stars do align. You know, it's like trying to find a sponsor, for example, in a 12-step program. You know, if you keep shopping for the right perfect person, you're going to be looking for a long time. Whoever is willing and able to help you, that's your sponsor. Find that person. Find someone who has what you want. Ask them how they got it and do what they did and try to build a relationship with them. It's not going to be perfect. You know, we're just trying to help each other. There's a beautiful thing in recovery, and you'll find this in yoga as well. In recovery, for example, there's a saying, we do it for fun and for free. Like, you don't get paid to help another guy or another person in recovery. You do it out of the debt of honor that someone did that for you. It's a debt of honor and service and love and gratitude that if another man took his time, his energy, his awareness, his experience, and he somehow saved my life, I can never pay him back. But the only way I could even try to pay him back is to try to give that to someone else. In that process, you're going to find a lot of people that don't want what you have, or they're going to argue with you, or maybe you're the one who's arguing with the person trying to help you. It's grist for the mill. It's all part of the process. So we just take what works and we can leave the rest. So in regard to trust issues, if you meet five people and two people aren't that nice, focus on the three that are. And it's a numbers game. Just keep trying. Same thing with reading spiritual books or going to yoga classes. Maybe you go to three classes and all the teachers are just not your kind of teacher. Pick a different studio, find an online class, just keep trying. There's a nut for every bolt. There's a lid for every pot. You'll find your teacher. You'll find your tribe. You'll find your group. That's why there's so many different types of 12-step programs. Even within certain areas or genres, it just speaks to our human condition. There's groups for every kind of thing. I think there's over 100 12-step groups now. It's a beautiful thing. It just shows how prevalent, but also how addiction can just take any form.
And I'll hear my friends say, oh, the Tuesday night group, they're a bunch of complainers. I don't want to go back to that one. But the Wednesday morning group, they are on track. I want to be like them. So even within AA or probably any kind of recovery process, like you said, try and try again. Like it just because you went to one meeting doesn't mean that's the vibe of every meeting.
And back to yoga as well. When I started practicing, I was doing power yoga, Ashtanga yoga, really strong vinyasa flow. And then at some point, my body was letting me know, we need to take a break here. This has been pretty intense for quite a while. I was doing that for about 10 years or so. And then it wasn't that I got a bunch of injuries. It was just that pace, that style. It was time for me to find a different group. So I went into restorative and yin and gentle and very Iyengar style. And all of a sudden this is my group now. And I didn't judge the old group like, oh, those guys are all hotheads. They're too intense for me. It's just, no, I'm just not there anymore. So sometimes we do fit in with certain people, and even the people we think we fit in with, at some point, that might change. That's what the Buddha said. Everything changes. Everything's impermanent. And so these days, I do a very gentle practice. I don't do 90-minute flows personally or even 1 hour. Usually, I just did yoga this morning. It was about 20 minutes. I just did some movements on my living room floor on a towel on the carpet. That was my practice. And that comes back to open-mindedness. It's one of the principles in the book. If we can be open-minded and continue to evolve, allow ourselves to develop our spiritual awareness, awareness of our physical capabilities, and also preferences. We're told a lot of times in spiritual books not to have likes or dislikes, or if you have some really strong likes and dislikes, try to simmer that down. I think really good to know the things that work well for you. and different foods that work well for your body. And it's okay to like those things without too much attachment to them. And so it's okay to say that Tuesday night group, they're a bunch of complainers. If that doesn't work for you, then go to the Wednesday morning where they focus on the solution and positive actions. We can keep moving that way.
So, Brian, I'm imagining that there are some people listening right now that are like, wow, I would really love to learn and study yoga and life with Brian. Do you offer any online groups or classes? Because not everybody lives near you.
What I have is audio courses on Insight Timer. In those courses, there's an interactive classroom. So that way we can work together. If you're listening to those lessons, you can ask questions or share your insights, reflections, ideas, thoughts. And I'm in there every day and I'm answering and helping support you through the course, the journey. The courses are about recovery. I believe I have four about recovery, two about Buddhist psychology or Dharma teachings, and then a few more. One's about gratitude. There's one about happiness. So lately, that's where I've been most active is online in Insight Timer.
You would just type in your name, Brian Hyman, and if they put that in Insight Timer, your courses would pop up.
Yes.
Beautiful. And how about a website? Do you have a website or Instagram page?
I do both brianhymanyoga.com and then on Instagram, that would be brianhymanyoga.
Great. I'm writing these down so we can put them in the show notes for you. So, is there any last bits of wisdom you'd like to share before we finish our time together today?
Just if anyone is in recovery, just to keep going and keep doing whatever it is that you're doing that's working for you. If anyone is on the fence or not sure if recovery is for them, hang in there and don't be afraid to ask for help. Like we talked about today, it can be really challenging for a lot of us to say we need help or to ask for help and to actually follow up on any kind of help or suggestions that are given to us. But I promise you, it's definitely worth it. Today, I am sober nearly 15 years. I just had a book published about recovery and yoga. My daughter's 9 years old. I get to be present today as a father, as a teacher, as a member of my community. I work at a treatment center. I get to try to help people every day. This isn't a life I imagined. When I got sober just before then, I was going through a really hard time. Like, I can relate to a lot of people in early recovery. I can remember what it was like. I was depressed. I had suicidal thoughts. I just thought, what's the point in living? Life sucks. I hate myself. Everything got really dark. And I guess it was either time to move, to shift, to get out of that place. I don't know what else could have happened. I'm just grateful that something did shift within me and I was able to ask for help. So if anyone is out there and they need help, don't be ashamed. Don't be embarrassed. You can reach out. And most likely anyone who's in recovery, if you reach out to them, they probably will respond pretty quickly because they'll remember what it was like when they had to ask for help. And they'll probably be there to support you. And you don't have to practice yoga to be in recovery. Yoga is just one tool. It's just one additional practice that's helpful for people in recovery. Most importantly, the recovery piece. If you need to find recovery, if you need to get away from a substance or a behavior, do what you need to do today.
Thank you so much, Brian, for your love, your generosity, and your willingness to share all of this with us. And I'll just say one more time, the book is called Recovery with Yoga: Supportive Practices for Transcending Addiction by Brian Hyman. And I'm really grateful that you're part of our community and you're doing this work. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for doing the work that you're doing out in the world with yoga therapy. It's amazing.
Thank you. Oh, I'm feeling so touched. Thank you so much, Brian, for this generous offering through the podcast today. And also, I just want to say that for anyone listening that is struggling with any type of addiction, could be shopping, could be eating, could be smoking, could be porn, could be love addiction, sex addiction, you know, there's so many different ways that we try to cover up and cope with this deep suffering that we have. I like to think of addiction as your way that you're trying to cope and come back to homeostasis and come back to feeling better. I know that sounds a little strange, but the addiction is the symptom, and we have to go back and try to figure out why we're suffering so much. So It doesn't take much to get on Insight Timer. It's a free app. You can download it onto your phone. They have over 150,000 meditations on there. And then if you want to go in the premium tier where you get 4,000 or more courses and can take these courses with Brian, that's only $5 a month. That's like the cup of coffee. So maybe that's your first humble step of acceptance. That you're going to go in, you're going to download your Insight Meditation app today. You're going to pay your $5, and then you'll get in those courses that Brian is offering and just start to take that first step. You don't have to worry about where it's going to end up. That's not important today. The first step is the humility and the willingness to step forward and say, yeah, I want some support. I need some nourishment, and I'm willing to take even a half a step and see what happens. So, I wish you well on your journey and thank you for listening today. Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. After several years of beta testing, we are finally ready to build a community around a mobile app, the Optimal State app on Android Store and in the iPhone Store. On this app, we're going to start hosting classes, regular meditation circles, and really start to build a community of yoga teachers, yoga therapists, Ayurvedic practitioners, and healthcare practitioners that want to come together on a regular basis and have a community that is empathetic and compassionate and kind and full of goodness that wants to grow spiritually together. So come on over to the app. You can download it now, try it for a month for free, and we'll be having regular community online offerings through the app, and we would love to see you over there. All right, we'll see you soon. A special thank you to our team here at Optimal State. We are truly a global family. George Mantuan, one of our executive producers. Adam Satchel, senior media producer and sound engineer from the Philippines. Krishna Panchal, a producer from Canada. Modupe Abdullahi, who does the show notes and is an editor for us from Nigeria. And Peter Morley, who wrote and produced the music for this show, who lives in Australia. Find more about Peter's work at www.zenmusic.biz. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.